This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It is episode 151, and it is Thursday today. I'm actually coming in for a little bit tomorrow. There's some guys that are working on some things, and I'm going to give them a little hand, which is good because I've kind of been a little slack coming in a little later than I should have been coming in a little, but, you know, so that's fine. It'll let me get caught up a little bit. And then I will go home and write. Anyways, it's been a good week. I've been pounding away on a project, trying to get it done as quickly as I possibly can. And that seems to be going well. We did a demo this afternoon with some of the clients' employees, and that seemed to go fine. So they're in the process of transitioning and training some people, and so once they get all their training done, then we'll move in behind and start attaching our systems to it. So I think it's going to be just fine. Do have a few little tweaks that I need to do, but it will be just fine. I actually have not had a chance to talk with many of my friends this week. That's been the only downside to this week. Did get together with the young couple I get together with on Saturdays, got a chance to see their kids. We talked about a lot of stuff, but then, first of all, Monday night we had bad weather, so didn't go to improv class on Monday night, so I usually have a chance to talk to my daughter when we're coming and going to that, and then Tuesday morning, the young father I get together with on Tuesday morning was sick. There is something going around that's just hammering people. He was sick, and so we didn't get together. And then the guy I normally get together with on Wednesday night, I had to cancel on him because we had a family friend in town. I'll talk about that in a minute. So I didn't get a chance to get together with him. And then tonight, the guy I usually get together with on Thursday nights, he was not able to get together with me. I did see my friend last Friday and had a nice time talking with him, although our time was mostly spent figuring out how he could get his poetry book published. And so I was showing him some different things in Word and about applying styles and those types of things, and so that kind of chewed up a lot of our time. But I will see him tomorrow, and we'll be good. And I did have a special conversation this week with a woman who is a family friend. She rented my mom and dad's house for a while, and so she was in town. She had already had supper with my parents, and she had called, and so we said, well, let's get together. And Wednesday was going to be the best night for us to get together. So my wife and I and her went to get some Chinese food, and I sat and watched them eat because Wednesday is fast day for me. And we got to jabbering, and then my wife had to go to church. So we sat in the restaurant and jabbered for a while, and then I took her back to... she's in town taking some classes at a local educational establishment, so I took her back there, and we jabbered in the car for a while, and then she gave me a little tour of the seminary, and so we jabbered there, and then she wanted to pray with me, so we went in the prayer room, we jabbered for a while, and then she prayed with me, and then we went and stood out in the parking lot and jabbered some more, and So it was fun. We talked about a wide variety of topics. And when she asked me, what would you like me to pray with you over? My mind immediately went to the big scene that's coming up in Grumpy Old Prophets that I'm working on, which is the crucifixion scene, which is the pivotal scene in Grumpy Old Prophets. And it is referred to in part one. It's referred to in the first book in part one. It's referred to in the second book in parts two and part three. And now we're actually getting to it in the third book, which is part four. So, you know, it better be good because I have been building up to this now for two books and three parts and half of the fourth part. I do have one additional scene. One chapter I need to finish up. And then there's the...
Excuse me.
Then there's the preparation for the crucifixion. And then there's the actual crucifixion chapter. So... this is going to be very interesting. So I asked her to pray with me that I would have clarity and that I would be able to express myself well in this chapter. I'm all about hitting the moment in my books. You know, if it's possible to hit a moment, to find a moment that will evoke emotion in my readers, I'm all about that. And so far, I seem to have been able to do that in the first two books. And I know where it's supposed to happen in this book. So we will see. I'm not sure I'm going to get to it this weekend. Because if everything goes really, really well, I may get right up to the edge of it. And then next week, I will have to get started writing it. So it's very exciting. It's also, I was going to say a little intimidating, but see, like, the whole point, one of the big points in Grumpy Old Prophets Part 4, which is Book 3, is there is nothing to fear. And I'm trying to write these books to where they not only speak to others, but they actually speak to me. And it's really true, there's nothing to fear. And so, you know, I'm just stepping up to it. And there's been some delightful little surprises that have come, and I'm actually in the middle of writing one of those now. Scenes that I didn't know were going to be there, and they just develop on their own, seemingly. And so, it's fun. It's fun. I have to do a little bit of work tomorrow, but then I'm hoping to get home and get several good hours on it tomorrow, and then several good hours on it Saturday and Sunday, and maybe get up to the crucifixion scene, and then we'll see. So, anyways, one of the things that Melissa and I talked about last night, just briefly, was what I'm interested in talking about today. There was a book that was published by Charles Murray called Coming Apart. And honestly, I probably... should have read the book, but that would have taken a little extra time. And there have been several people on both sides of the ideological aisle who have commented on the book, and I felt like reading through their op-ed pieces, I got enough of it that I think I kind of know where I come down in the ideological argument over the validity of the book. The book, called Coming Apart, chronicles what the author believes is a fundamental separation that is happening in our society. And the author makes the claim that America is dividing into a two-caste society. And he has all this data to illustrate the fact. But the gist of it is that in 1963, there certainly was a gap between the rich and the poor. But it wasn't that big. And he goes on to chronicle the prices and the difference in prices. And he says, you know, there was a significant difference between a luxury car, the cost of a luxury car, and the cost of a normal car. Yes, 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 yes. However, when you looked at other things like employment, what you had is roughly 98% of men between the ages of 30 and 49 were in the labor force. Didn't matter whether you were in the upper class or the lower class, they were in the labor force. Such is not the case today. And there has been this widening divide between the upper class and the lower classes. And it's to the point that this author doesn't even think that the word class accurately captures anymore this divide. And they were quoting a lot of statistics, but I just highlighted a couple that I thought were pretty interesting. In terms of behavioral gaps, there's been a huge difference. They were talking about the fact, let me just glance at my notes, I'm stopped at a stoplight, between the educated upper class, 20% of the country, and the lower class, 30% of the country. There has now become a huge behavioral difference between. In the educated upper class, there's only about 70% of the white kids in the upper tribe, they call them. 7% born out of wedlock, and it's almost 45% in the lower tribe. In the upper tribe, nearly every man age 30 to 49 is in the labor force. In the lower tribe, men in their prime working ages have steadily been dropping out of the labor force in good times and bad. People in the lower tribe are much less likely to get married. They're less likely to go to church. They are less likely to be active in their communities, more likely to watch TV excessively, and more likely to be obese. And apparently in the book, the author makes the claim that the people in the educated upper tribe have really become extremely productive. They have paid attention to raising their kids. They've seen that their kids have gotten good educations. They have low divorce rates. They have strong work ethics. And they have strict codes whereby they regulate their children's behavior. Members of the lower tribe work hard and dream big, but are more removed from traditional bourgeoisie norms, or just the traditional way of living. They live in disorganized, postmodern neighborhoods in which it is harder to be self-disciplined and productive. So that's the basic idea. What's interesting is that conservative and liberals interpret this two completely different ways. And as I was reading the op-ed pieces, the conservatives were pointing to the moral decay in America, and they were saying, okay, we have to fix that. You know, we have to get people back into a two-parent home and get more discipline into the home. And I was reading one liberal commentator when he was saying, where he was saying, you know, that's not the problem at all. It's not morality that's a problem, it's money is the problem. The problem is there aren't jobs. He was citing a statistic that said, well, but the teenage pregnancy rates dropped like crazy in the 90s. So he was saying, well, maybe having a strong family, strong two-parent family, is not that big of a deal. Because if it was that big of a deal, why were the teenage pregnancy rates dropping? And why did the violent crime drop? Okay, I'm not sure what the statistics are in the 2000s, though. Maybe they dropped in the 1990s. I mean, it is true they dropped in the 1990s. And there was a boom time in the 1990s. But as I was talking to Melissa last night, I said, you know, it just seems to me that the core issue here for society is how do we instill in our individual members the desire to be productive units of society. And for me, where we started turning things on their heads was back when the baby boomers went through the 60s, and there was this mass of young people that wanted to do their own thing. And we got into the free love era in the 60s. At the same time, television was making a transition, because in the 50s, television was all about reinforcing the values of middle America. They were very careful. It was a new medium. They didn't want to offend people. And so you had a lot of family dramas where there was a strong father figure, and the father was the one that was dispensing wisdom, or the mom was the one that was dispensing wisdom, and the kids would learn. I mean, there's just a whole host of shows out there under that formula. And then as you start moving into the 60s, the creative people started pushing the envelope, because that's creative people. They're always pushing the envelope. And when you have businesses that are looking to sell products, what's important is not necessarily the content of the television show. What's important is how many people are watching. How do we attract the maximum number of eyeballs? And so the very predictable course happens where, to be a little more titillating, to be a little more controversial, to give people something they don't just see at home or on normal television, we push the envelope a little bit. That gets more eyeballs on it. Then the advertisers come. To where now television, instead of reflecting the middle class values of hard work and good parenting and those things, now it starts pushing. It starts pushing and showing as a norm disrespectful kids, stupid fathers, all those things. And pretty much any sitcom where there are married people on it, what you see is at least one man who's a buffoon and a wife who has to kind of keep him in line, and the kids are rebellious and sassy and yada, yada, yada. There have been exceptions, obviously. There have been exceptions. But a lot of that is pushed. And in conjunction with that, marketers have come up with a brilliant idea that in order to get people to buy more stuff, you have to convince them that really the world revolves around them. That we promote narcissism by our advertising. Have it your way. Oh, you need a treat. Oh, yes. Oh, look at this great thing I just bought for myself, and it makes me feel so much better. A lot of the advertising is focused on telling you why you're incomplete and why when you get this, you'll be much better. And I think this generates an attitude of narcissism if you're not careful and you don't pay attention. The upshot of all that, I think, is that you get this push towards being self-absorbed, and that leads to a breakdown in families because no one wants to work on marriages and keep going. And so you end up with divorce and broken families and those types of things, and now you have children being raised in an environment where there is narcissistic behavior. Now, how the upper middle class has managed to avoid that, I'm not really sure. But obviously, they're not believing the whispers from their own TVs. And instead of just sitting around waiting for everything to come to them, they've actually gotten up and gotten out and worked hard. And they have had opportunities. I'm well aware of the fact that I'm a white male, and that has allowed me to have certain opportunities. And I'm tall, and that has given me other opportunities. By the same token, I have something that I feel is absolutely essential in my life, and that's impulse control and self-discipline. Because in the final analysis, impulse control and self-discipline make up for a world of lack in terms of resources and in terms of social standing. And if you doubt that at all, you should look at the Asian immigrants. And before them, the European immigrants, like my grandfather, who came over with nothing, barely spoke the language, and yet, after a few years, in terms of Asian immigrants, you know, they end up with businesses, small little businesses, they work and work and work, they save up, I'm getting my mail. They start little businesses, and then they add to their businesses, and they just keep building and building and building because they are very focused. They have a high degree of impulse control, high degree of self-discipline. Well, the critical thing in terms of all this talk about the Great Divide and the two tribes and the diverging classes in America, the critical thing for me is, well, where does this self-discipline come from? Because if it's an essential part of living a successful life, then where does that self-discipline come from? And the fact is that no one learns self-discipline of themselves. You always have to learn it from somebody else. You can absolutely learn it from a single parent. You can. And there have been some very inspiring stories of people who were born into very low-income situations, into poverty, rough neighborhoods, but they learned self-discipline from someone, most likely their parent or parents. I personally think what's going on with these tribes is that while the family is not the only place, the two-parent family is not the only place that you can learn self-discipline. You can learn it from a single parent. If you have a strong mother and father who are involved with the child, I think you stand a much better chance of coming out with a child who has impulse control and who has self-discipline. It doesn't guarantee it, but you stand a much better chance. And that child then has a much better chance to succeed. So while the two-parent family is not a guarantor of having a child with self-discipline, I think it's a huge benefit. And so it makes perfect sense to me that if you've got one tribe who are very dedicated to their families, they have low divorce rates, they don't have a lot of children who are born out of wedlock, I find it more likely that those families are going to instill in their children a sense of discipline. Not all of them will, but most will. On the other hand, if you have children being born out of wedlock whose parents are sitting around and watching a lot of TV, aren't able to find jobs or don't have jobs, and are obese on top of all that, it's less likely that they're going to teach their kids self-discipline and impulse control. And so the cycles just keep getting worse. And they just keep getting worse and worse and worse. You know, as to what the solution is, I was reading one author, he was saying that once a society starts coming apart like this, it's very difficult to get it back together. And honestly, I don't know that there's any kind of big government program that can solve this. One guy suggested that we have some sort of national service program again, where young people can go into this national service program and learn self-discipline by being mentored. And you know me, I'm big on discipleship. Maybe that's a solution. But it's going to be very easy, very interesting to watch over the next few years to see where this all leads. Because it seems like there's only a few places it can lead, and it seems more likely that the divide will just keep getting wider, unfortunately. Because once the flesh is manifested and the flesh gets a foothold, typically the flesh just keeps increasing its influence. And when you have people being born out of wedlock and people being raised by others who spend all day watching TV and they're unable, or they don't go out and find jobs, you know, and they're, that typically is not a highly disciplined environment. And especially if they're getting, people are getting discouraged because they're trying to find jobs and there's no work. I mean, you know, all those things are in the mix. And I certainly am not trying to say that the job situation is all the fault of the lower tribe, because we've gotten pounded in this country. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that all works out. It's a fascinating time in this country. But I don't think I agree with the liberal who was saying that he didn't believe the family was that big of a deal. The dissolution of the family was that big of a deal. Because, and it's mainly because I think it's more likely someone raised in a two-person family, it's more likely that they will have a sense of self-discipline and have a sense of impulse control. And that really, for me, is the key. And, you know, I think it would help if we didn't get a steady diet from the media that impulse control is boring and self-discipline is boring. Because if you look at most of the heroes that are on television, they're always, oh, stepping outside the line, breaking the rules, because I can't, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. But I don't think we're going to change that anytime soon either. So, very interesting article. The book, again, was called Coming Apart, Charles Murray. And there's a ton of op-ed pieces on it around, of people weighing in on their own opinions. So I thought I would weigh in with my very small opinion as well. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.